good Saturday to you. How are you doing? How's everything going? I'm feeling great today. You know, I mentioned last week I got my website up, and that is huge because not only do we have a lot of good information on there, but I'm finally able to put all these episodes up there. We got 140 episodes, and when you go to Earth Ancients, it's earthancients.com. Go to the episode page. We're going to have everything broken into subjects. You can go to sacred geometry. You can go to lost civilizations. You can go to unknown technology. I mean, there's so many cool topics that you can download and listen to in the comfort of your, you know, phone or your computer or whatever. And I'm so happy because it really makes a difference to have a website, you know. And here I am, a marketing technology manager, and I haven't had a website since we started this show. So check it out. There's a lot of fun stuff on there, and you know, it's a lot of people ask me, what is Earth Ancients all about? Why did you get going on it? And this is what I wrote. If you go to about, this is what I wrote about it. Earth Ancients chronicles the growing and often suppressed evidence of known and unknown civilizations, their ruined cities and artifacts developed from advanced science and technology. Erased from the pages of time, these cultures discovered and charted the heavens, developed machines and unleashed advances that parallel and in many cases surpass our own. Join us and discover our lost history. That's just the beginning. I go into a lot more detail, but that's just the tip of the iceberg about what Earth Ancients is. We're all about rediscovering where we've been. And if you're here with me listening each week, you have a want to know. You want to know more. And I'm very deeply frustrated with the historical perspective we have on the ancient past. And the orthodox science, those are the ones who make up the rules. They've been anointed to write the history books and tell us where we've come from, who discovered what. And it's all pretty much wrong. Not every single aspect of our history is wrong, obviously, but the ancient unknown history after, the Egyptians, who we know a lot about, before them, then it gets really fuzzy. So anyhow, check out Earth Ancients, check out the pages in there, and I'm offering a raffle. I got 5 copies of Graham Hancock's book, Magicians of the Gods, and I am raffling them off. So when you go to this page, go scroll down to the homepage and sign up, register. Not only will you be entered in a raffle, I have 5 copies, so it was a good chance that you'll, you know, be close to getting one. But not only that, you'll get information and newsletters that are coming up, special articles. I'm starting to write more blogs now, announcements on books, not only that I'm going to be writing, but what other people are writing, and the importance of those books, which are mostly about Earth Ancients, things like that. So go to Earth Ancients, www.earthancients.com, and sign up. In the news this week, there's a great article by Wilhelm Witwen, who we've had on the show before, on the Giza pyramids, and new information on how they were built. And you can go to Facebook, earthancients.com. And it's a 2-part article that appeared in ancientorigins.com, but I've permission to publish it on our Facebook page. And it's very, very interesting. Like I said, we had him on the show. He's researched the pyramids of Giza fairly thoroughly and has found some new evidence that's kind of eye-opening that you might want to check out. So Earth Ancients, Facebook, go to the group page. The other interesting news, or actually, it's not news. It's a new gallery that we put up by one of our members of Tonilla ruins, the ruins in Chiapas, Mexico, and these are Mayan ruins that are extremely old, but very, very sophisticated in that they are artificially leveled. And the Maya had, and we don't quite know how they did it, they were able to level surfaces on the ground, but also up to, you know, 20 and 30 feet, sometimes as high as 50 feet into the air, and engineer these structures that have pyramids or pyramid complexes that are sitting on them. And Tonilla is one of these areas that has these artificial leveled platforms that are fascinating. My guess is that when they were originally built, they probably had other structures or features that we just don't know about. But when you check out this gallery, and there's like 40 images in this gallery, you'll see that it's quite unique, and it's quite an eye opener too. So check it out, Earth Ancients Facebook. Go to the group page, and it's kind of fun. It's kind of fun to look at.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
And this is another interesting article that just came up. In Australia, they are now estimating that they have found the oldest observatory in the world. It's an Aboriginal observatory. It's dated at 11,000 years old. It was found by a research team out there. And, you know, if it's that old, it's older than Stonehenge or the Great Giza Plateau area where the pyramids are. Well, according to conventional science, we think it's probably older there, Giza pyramids. But 11,000 years old. You can read all about this, and there's some very, very good photographs of this observatory, as well as what they think it was pointing to in the heavens. And there's a number of features that in the stoneworks that apparently point to specific areas. It's on the Facebook page. Go to Earth Ancients. It's called the world's oldest observatory, how Aboriginal astronomy provides clues to the ancient past. And it was in the Australian news. Fascinating story. This is the kind of stuff that's mind-blowing, simply because it shows that there was sophisticated astronomy. There was sophisticated thinking thousands and thousands of years ago. And although it's a megalithic site, the stonework works were developed and obviously put together by people who understood the importance of looking to the heavens. So anyhow, that's big news in my mind. So check it out, Earth Ancients Facebook group page. Hey, I've mentioned that in April of next year, I'm going to be taking some people down to the Yucatan, Maya land. And I'm taking, I'll probably max it at 25 people. But if you want to come down with me, we're going to meet in Cancun. And I'm going to have some elders to talk about the Mayan culture. We're going to learn about meditation. We're going to do some meditative practices that kind of with these ancient sites, and then we're going to go and actually visit some of these pyramid complexes in the Yucatan. We'll go see Chichen Itza, but I really want people to see Ekbalam. Ekbalam has a number of these long-headed individuals who were reproduced in sculptural form, and they're beautiful. They surround a number of features on this pyramid, the main pyramid at Ekbalam. We'll try to get to some of the smaller areas, and my goal is, and we will definitely plan a trip to Koba and climb the main pyramid there. to get the vibes there and maybe sit up on top for maybe 20, 30 minutes. That is an active pyramid. And when I say active, they built that over a geomagnetic field. And when you stand up on top of there, it's like, you know, you're getting blasted. And some people feel it immediately. Some people feel it when they get down off the pyramid. And it's really an experience to go there. So it's going to be the first week of April. I'll have more details. If you want to join me, I'm going to make it as reasonable as possible, but obviously we have costs involved for your hotel, for food, for travel, and for permits to get into some of these places. Send me an email, cliff@earthancients.com, and I'll send more information to you. I'll be mentioning more about this as we firm up the details and we get the hotel arrangements together. Only about 20, 25 people max. I used to do tours, years ago. I did just handfuls of people that I took from conferences, and we would go to Uxmal, which is a fascinating place on the Gulf of Mexico side of the peninsula. But this is something different. I've learned a lot since then, and it's important to focus on the mind, body, and spirit when you go to these places. And so we'll interact with all those phases. And if you don't meditate or have any understanding of meditation, you'll get a sense of it. And I like to give people tools when I do these tools, these tours. And the tools are what you can take with you to use as you like. And it's all about enhancement. It's all about being physical, but being enhanced to reach the unseen levels. So cliff@earthancients.com. Let me know if you want to come, and you can join me. It's going to be a blast. Mexico is so much fun, and it's cheap too. I want to remind you that Earth Ancients is sponsored by Gaia.com, or Gaia. And Gaia is offering us a special program. And if you don't know about Gaia, Gaia is an amazing streaming media website. They have subjects that we cover, but even more than what we cover. We cover a lot, but there's series from Graham Hancock, Dave Wilcox, William Henry, Greg Braden, just hundreds of these amazing authors and presenters, and they have series from them. There's specials on NASA, on what's happening on Mars, all people that you hear from on Earth Ancients. They're the perfect sponsor. And the special they're offering is for the first month, it's 99 cents to join. And I think it's $9 after every month. So Please join them, because it really helps me, helps the organization, which is Earth Ancients, to keep growing. You can join by going to Gaia, it's GAIA.com/Earth Ancients, that's Ancients with an S, and sign up. Sign up, because not only is it very, very cool, but they support what we're doing, and that's important for us. So Gaia.com/Earth Ancients. Okay, here's the interview today. We have Andrew Collins. The topic is Atlantis. I think you're really going to like this. And I'll come back at the end after we're done. So we've heard compelling evidence for a number of ancient cultures around the world. We see it throughout Mexico, we see it in South America, throughout Europe, now in the Russian area, former Soviet Union, there's evidence of extremely advanced cultures there. There's evidence everywhere. In the Middle East, obviously, with the dynastic Egyptians and the Great Pyramid, the Sphinx. And a number of people have written about the legend of Atlantis. We've heard from various people in Indonesia talking about what they believe was Atlantis. I'm not quite sure that isn't confused with Lemuria or a place called Mu. But I find significant evidence of very sophisticated cultures in Central America. My personal interest, of course, is the Maya, who I believe are the descendants of a very sophisticated civilization, simply because they are a pyramid culture, and pyramids are not simple structures to build. It requires advanced science, advanced mathematics, and, of course, construction techniques. My guest today is Andrew Collins, and Andrew's been with us before. He's a prolific author, and he's written a new book called Atlantis in the Caribbean and the Comet that Changed the World. And I've had a chance to look at this book. It's a fascinating book. It's quite large, and it's filled with wonderful information. And there's just so much to talk about regarding Atlantis, because Atlantis wasn't a simple civilization. There's evidence that it was quite large and had its hands around the world. But really a pleasure to have you on the program today, Andrew.
It's my pleasure, Cliff.
Fantastic. You've written quite a bit about, and I read your newsletter, which, by the way, I think more people need to take a look at Andrew's newsletter. It's quite well-researched, and every time I get it, I'm like flabbergasted, because he's turned another rock over and revealed the information. But this new book focuses on the Caribbean, and you make a lot of conclusions which are quite significant. And I want to start with somebody who I didn't know about, which is a gentleman named Johan Klosterman, who's a Dutch geologist and mineralogist, who actually did some quite interesting research. Can you talk a little bit about his work and how that influenced you?
I can, yeah. Well, I mean, obviously Atlantis is a big subject, as you've said, and we'll get on to what the evidence is and mm-hmm. what Plato actually states about where to find Atlantis. But the one thing we can say is that the time frame that Plato gives for its destruction is approximately 9,600 BC. Now, this has been a big sticking point with historians up till recently, because they've said, you know, how can he possibly be talking about such an early age of humanity? Well, today what we know is that the cataclysm that Plato describes as destroying Atlantis sounds remarkably like a actual catastrophe that befell the world between about 10,800 BC, that's when it started, and it carried on in one form or another right the way through till about 9,600 BC. Now, that's the exact time that Plato tells us. And this was triggered by a comet impact. When I say an impact, I mean it was actually probably fragments of a comet that was spread right the way across the North American continent, across the Atlantic Ocean and into the Eurasian continent, would have affected parts of that. But the greatest place of impact was unquestionably North America. Mm-hmm. And this took place initially around 10,800 BC. And it would have triggered wildfires that would have devastated woodland and forests right the way across the continent. But at the same time, pieces of the comet hit the ice sheets that had been occupying areas of North America and, of course, the Eurasian continent for you know, tens of thousands of years on and off. And these melted the waters very quickly, which would have rushed down south through the valleys and the gorges, which would have effectively extinguished many of the wildfires, but they would also have completely wiped out anything that was in their path. Now, on top of that, as the wildfires were burning, and they could have burned, you know, not just for a few days, but possibly years, even decades, and they sent up into the upper atmosphere a thick black smoke, a toxic smoke, which remained there for a period of time. Again, we don't know how long. It could have been weeks, months, could have been years. But what it did was to block out the sun and the moon, and it plunged the planet into a mini ice age that lasted for about 1,200 years. And that's known as the Younger Dryas event. Mm-hmm. And that, in fact, scientists today refer to this comet impact as the Younger Dryas comet impact event. And on top of this, when this debris in the sky eventually fell down to Earth, which it would have been, which it would have done very gradually as dust, but also as acid rain, quite literally, it would have formed a layer in the Earth, which would remain as like a dark layer of ash. And what Hans Klostermann has been doing is been investigating this thick black layer that's been found on virtually every continent of the world, in many, many different countries, from, you know, from Australia to Egypt to Russia to Britain, France, Belgium, Holland, obviously the United States. Has been found in South America, Central America, and surely it's there in many other places around the world. But it's probably around, it's anything between about 4 to 6 inches in depth. And it's a thick, black, oily substance. I mean, I was in Holland, and we crossed over the border into Belgium to look at an archaeological dig where they'd uncovered this thick black layer. I was with Hans Klostermann, and he was pointing it out to me. Mm-hmm. And I was able to scrape away some of it and put it into my hands, and it was very greasy. And it felt very much like if you have a bonfire in the back garden and you then dig the earth just beneath it that's also been scorched, that's often very greasy as well. And it felt exactly the same. And what's so weird is that it felt as if it had been placed there, you know, just a decade ago. I mean, it didn't feel like it had been set down nearly 12,000 years ago, which was quite remarkable. But what Hans Klostermann said was that he pointed out that immediately below this black layer was this white area within this sandy soil. And he said that this was caused either by a intensive heat blast from above or from intense acid rain. They were studying the chemicals to try and analyze exactly what had caused it, but it was either one of those. And obviously this was terrifying. And the fact also is that below this black layer is evidence of a high culture existing in Western Europe, just as it did in North America and then obviously in many other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. It disappears at the point of this black layer. And on top of it, eventually another culture comes in with much more cruder stone tools. And that tells us a hell of a lot. Mm-hmm. What it says is that these people were either wiped out or were forced to leave this area in the wake of this cataclysm. And what Hans Klostermann has been able to do is show that these black layers are all part of the same thing around the world. And they are named after the first site that they were discovered, which was the site that I went to, which is a place called Usillu. Mm-hmm. In Belgium, and they call it the Usilla Horizon. And for this reason, that's why he's well known, basically. So he's basically said that the evidence of this cataclysm can be found all the way around the world. Doesn't matter where you are, mm-hmm. you will find evidence of it, because that ash layer covered the entire Earth. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously very frightening stuff. And I think that what we have to do is put all this into context, that people would never have forgotten this event. You know, they would have remembered it in their myths and their legends and their folk stories and their poetry for thousands of years, passing it on from generation to generation. And particularly in the area where we're interested in here, and this is the Caribbean, mm-hmm. and the Bahamas, because there's evidence here that this cataclysm almost destroyed these islands. In fact, previous to this time, the Bahamas was itself an island continent. Mm-hmm. And I think that this was Plato's lost continent. It was the continent that actually sank. But having said that, what Plato also says is that, Atlantis was a series of islands that came together to become a continent. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty certain that the evidence points towards Cuba being the flagship of the Atlantic, the Antian continent or empire, as Plato ends up calling it.
Let's move to the Caribbean in a second. I have another question about this work that Klosterman discovered. What I find curious, and it appears also in Graham Hancock's new book, Magicians of the Gods. He spends a third of the book talking about the Younger Dryas event and these asteroid hits, which he very, and you also have it in your book, these the Carolina Bays apparently are remnants of this asteroid cluster and pulverizing the Earth. But what I want to ask you is there any evidence of mass grave sites? Because it would have destroyed pretty much the humanity on Earth at this time, this 12,000 plus years ago. Is there any evidence of mass human graveyards or fields of dead bodies with this layer on it that you've described?
Not for humans. Nothing like that's really been discovered. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not sure what that actually says. I don't think it says that it didn't happen. I just don't think that we haven't found it as yet.
Okay.
But certainly for animals, because a lot of the so-called megafauna of the Pleistocene, which was the last geological age that came to the end around this time, they all disappear. I mean, we're talking about everything from sort of saber-toothed tigers to giant camels to giant sloths. Right. So obviously the mammoth, although the mammoth did survive in small pockets around the world after this time, but certainly they were greatly reduced. And a writer back in, I think, the 40s or 50s wrote all about these this muck that's discovered from the late Paleolithic, the Pleistocene age, that was full of not just the bones of animals from this era, but they seem to have been torn apart. You know, that parts of their body were obviously were quite literally wrenched apart.
Right.
And amongst them was tons of logs of wood, which had all been pushed down in a very similar manner, as if by some great force. Now, I won't quote the name because I'm trying to get it into my head, but I think it's a guy called Hibden who wrote about American prehistory in, I think, the 50s and 60s. I mean, I've quoted it on various occasions, and and I know that Graham Hancock has as well, and it's quite clear this is talking about some kind of killing fields.
Well, you know, Velikovsky talks just about that in his books, how the mountains of bones that have been
That's exactly it. Yeah. And I think that Velikovsky was probably quoting from the same source that I'm talking about here.
Yeah.
As I said, I won't try and remember the name anymore, but you know, it's certainly in my books. I think I initially quoted this material, I think, in From the Ashes of Angels, a book I did in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, quite clearly, you know, people like Graham Hancock and myself have been onto this since the 90s. I mean, we've been gathering evidence, we've used it in our books, and with each decade, more and more has come out relating to this. So we're able to fine-tune the information that we put in these books that we write.
Right.
And of course, if something is correct, you're only going to get more evidence for it. If something's wrong, you're not.
Mm-hmm.
And this is right. I mean, I am certain that the world underwent a terrible cataclysm around 10,800 BC, which lasted for at least several hundred years afterwards. I mean, there's evidence of wildfires burning for several hundred years afterwards.
Wow.
And that it probably didn't end until around 9,600 BC, which was the final part of the Younger Dryas mini ice age,
right.
Which Hans Klostermann says to me, and he took me to one side and he said, I'm certain that this ice age ended very sharply, very quickly with another cataclysm. I said, what type of cataclysm? He said, we don't know yet. He said, but the end of this ice age occurred so quickly, certainly within a generation. And that we're talking about the changes of trees, the changes of environment, the changes of temperature, everything, mm-hmm. that it has to have been caused by some kind of cataclysmic event. Now, whether it was another cosmic event, another impact, we don't know. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, quite clear, this would have been a terrible time for humanity to have existed.
Right.
And I think that this is one of the reasons why these stories were passed down until they eventually reach the ears of people like Plato. And I think, obviously, we need to address how Plato came across this story in the first place.
Please, yeah.
Well, I can tell you that it wasn't from Egypt. I mean, there is absolutely nothing in Plato's account that suggests that the story came from Egypt. I mean, the only possible thing that he could have got is the high dates. You know, the we're talking thousands of years, you know, 9,600 BC.
Right.
Because he talks about similar dates in another book of his called The Republic. So somehow these high dates are familiar to him. And these high dates can be found in Egyptian records of like these mythical gods and kings that reigned and things like that. You know, the so-called Turin papyrus, the Turin tablet, which contains the canon of the kings and things like this, and various other ones as well. So that's the only possibility. But the rest of it, the names that he quotes, the places that he cites in his accounts, all very clearly have a Semitic root. And that Semitic root almost certainly is Phoenicians and Carthaginians. Now, these were the high traders in the first and probably even the second millennium BC, or certainly their predecessors. And they would seem to have been navigating the Atlantic Ocean and reaching as far as the Gulf of Mexico and obviously the Caribbean, the Bahamas. And the chances are that they were encountering the indigenous peoples that lived in these regions. And once they got to know them, because remember, they were dealing specifically with trade. And some of this trade was done through like a blind trade commerce thing, where they would actually leave goods on a beach. The local people would come and leave something, you know, in return for the for the objects that were being bartered, and if it wasn't enough, you know, the objects would be left, and eventually there was some kind of agreement would be made, and this was called sort of like this blind bargaining. But quite clearly, in other areas, they would have had to enter into some kind of trade agreement with the local cultures and civilizations. And I think it's at this time that they start learning about this cataclysm, this comet impact that took place, and that knowledge, not only relating to these islands, are coming back into the Mediterranean world and being debated in the philosophical schools that people like Plato would have been a part of.
Mm-hmm.
But more than this, these stories also contain the knowledge of how all these islands had originally been one landmass, and that mm-hmm. the cataclysm had broken them apart, and now they were just, you know, either islands or they were drowned, and that in their place were just seaweed and, you know, mud shoals and things like this. And we can be pretty certain that these stories were told to the earliest mariners, because that's exactly what happened when the first Europeans reached the New World with Columbus mm-hmm. at the end of the 15th century.
Right.
The first explorers, the first chroniclers and historians that went in the wake of Christopher Columbus learnt from the local people, the indigenous peoples of the Caribbean and the Bahamas, about this great cataclysm, about this thing that appeared in the sky like a serpent, or some say the old moon broke and it fell into the sea. And then there was a period of darkness, and then the waters came and drowned everything. And obviously other types of, you know, cataclysmic activity went on. clearly these people are recalling an event that took place. And I looked very carefully into whether there could have been later cataclysms just a few thousand years ago, and there is no evidence. The only one that we've got is the Younger Dryas event. So in other words, these stories go back at least 11,000 to 12,000 years. And that's quite remarkable.
Fascinating. Let's let's focus on the Caribbean area. Your book primarily focuses on that surrounding area and the Yucatan and Central America. We've had Greg Little on the show, and he has really opened our eyes not only on his diving exhibitions and finding the ruins of buildings and structures underneath, specifically the Caribbean area, but there's really compelling evidence of a very high civilization in that area. And this is the focus of your book. Now, what is your feeling of you say Cuba is an area. I don't know of any really significant ruins on Cuba that would kind of mark it as a central area, whereas the Yucatan Peninsula is just littered with the ruins of pyramid cultures that may have predated the Maya. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, when I began to investigate Plato's account, I did it step by step. You know, in fact, what I did was I actually photocopied every page from the books, or you know, his Atlantis account, which is in two dialogues, the Timaeus and the Critias, and I actually pasted them around the walls of my kitchen, so that every time I had breakfast, every time I made a cup of tea, every time I had a meal, I would have to stare at the pages until I knew every single one of them. And because the reason I did that is because I wanted to go back to the beginning. I wanted not to be influenced by other people's books, but I wanted to see where he himself had laid clues as to where Atlantis was. And basically, he says that it was a series of islands very close to what he calls the opposite continent. Now, what he said was that in ancient times, mariners, voyagers, as he calls them, were able to reach the opposite continent using these islands as stepping stones. And these voyagers were from his own world. Now, this is very clearly a reference to the area of the Bahamas and the Caribbean. That's exactly what the first Europeans did at the time of Columbus. They used those islands as stepping stones to reach the opposite continent, which of course is the American continent. I mean, it's not China or Japan or Java or anything like that. It's clearly the United States and all the other countries in the American continents. And so we're looking in that area. So if you look at the accounts that he gives, the description of the central island of Atlantis fits almost perfectly the geography of Cuba. So then I started to look at Cuba, and as yet the oldest evidence of activity there goes back probably about 6,000 BC. Having said that, a large number of very strange ruins and idols and things like that were discovered by the first explorers to reach the region, but clearly they were all destroyed. I mean, you know, these were seen as pagan temples, they were seen as the devil's idols and things like that. They were either destroyed or obviously they were sold and vanished. So we have no idea what type of high culture or civilization may have existed. We know that there was a mound building culture there that goes back probably to the same type of age as that in the United States. And that now we know probably goes back to at least 4,000 BC, maybe even 5,000 BC. And earlier than that, there is a prejudice. I mean, archaeologists will not even accept that there was anybody on the Bahamas before about 500 or 600 AD. And yet there is caves deep underwater off the Bahamas that have petroglyphs in them, that have burials and bones and enough human activity to show that our ancestors got inside these places and were using them at a very early point. And quite clearly, this was when the water was much lower. And that takes us back probably at least 5,000, maybe even 10,000 BC.
Right.
And that's before we even start looking at the evidence of high culture in the region. I mean, obviously, people used to live by the water in the past. They never used to live, particularly in very hot, you know, jungle type environments. They would live very much close to the coast. They would set up everything to, you know, around them, their buildings, their the docks, the quays that boats would use. And what we know is that at the end of the last ice age, the end of the Younger Dryas event, the waters rose extremely rapidly, almost certainly due to the ice meltwater coming down from the ice sheets in, you know, the northern part of North America and Canada and Alaska and places like this. And this was flowing into the Gulf of Mexico and making the land submerge very, very quickly. So within a very short time, all of these coastal cultures would have been completely devastated. And now, today, they're almost certainly in anything up to, you know, 120 feet of water, possibly even more. And we certainly know that evidence has been found of what appear to be artificial structures, archaeological features off the coast of a great many Caribbean and Bahaman islands. As you mentioned, my good friends Greg and Laura Little have done an incredible job to reveal the existence of these sites in the Bahamas, and more unquestionably await discovery in the Caribbean. And I mean, Cuba, we haven't really had a chance to explore the coastal waters of Cuba because of the regimes there and the fact that it's been anathema to the United States. And, you know, it's a place which people didn't want to discover anything. But now it's all beginning to open up, and I believe that incredible discoveries will be made. I mean, in the year 2000, a Canadian salvage company, a salver called ADC Communications, discovered what they believed were almost like a lost city off the west coast of Cuba. I talk all about that in the book. And this is precisely in the area that I had predicted in the book that you would find evidence of Plato's Atlantis, right in that southwest to western corner of that. Because if you go by Plato's own actual account, that's where you should be looking for his central city of the island of Atlantis.
Exactly. You know, it's sad. I continue to spend a great deal of time in the Yucatan Peninsula and in Mexico because it's close to where I live here in San Francisco. And no one really talks in academic circles about where the Maya got their knowledge to build these complex pyramid structures and canals, and how they understood how water works, and how the not only the Aztec but other native cultures in Central America developed the ability to become a pyramid culture. Now, you touch on these cultures quite nicely in your book, and you actually give some great evidence for a possible link to an earlier high culture of Atlantis. Would you say your belief is that the Maya and other native cultures are the descendants of Atlantis, or are you just kind of speculating?
I'm speculating, of course, but I think that the evidence does point in that direction. I mean, the Aztec, the Maya, and various other, societies and cultures of Central America all talk about their earliest ancestors coming out of the East, for the most part, from an island at the beginning of time, a time of darkness. And they say that their ancestors, which are usually seven, and they say that these seven created the seven tribes, came from a place called the Seven Caves. And that this is where humanity emerged. You know, obviously they talk about different world ages as well. And I have done a lot of research on this, and all the indications are is that this island is in the Caribbean somewhere, and the most obvious site of it is Cuba. And as far as the actual location of the seven caves, which in the Aztec tradition is known as Chicamoztoc, the seven caves, is probably the Isle of Youth, which is in the southwest corner of Cuba, just obviously off of its coast. And here you've got this incredible series of seven caves. One in particular is decorated with the most incredible petroglyphs, which look like something that you would find in the caves of Europe from the Paleolithic era. And I was able to visit them as part of the research of the book, and it's in a very hostile jungle environment today. But quite clearly, these caves represent something, and going inside them and seeing this imagery, I looked at all these incredible concentric circles that all overlaid each other, and the first thing it said was almost like dropping a pebble into water and all of the ripples that come out from that pebble and that movement. But then if you drop another pebble, it sort of goes over the top and the ripples begin to combine together, and that's what I felt was being shown here, something falling into the water. And it was at that point that I started to realize that what was being shown here was an abstract memory of a cataclysm where the peoples here believed that in the past something had fallen into the water, some kind of comet fragment, and had probably caused a super tsunami and had probably drowned the islands. And that this is what they were trying to do. They were trying to tell that story in abstract form of the cataclysm that had occurred and that had devastated this region. And obviously, they didn't even need words. They just painted it in symbolic form.
Fascinating. You have a very interesting portion of your book where you talk about what appears to be a advanced maritime civilization. And the evidence of this is tobacco, and they found cocaine on very ancient Egyptian rulers, not only in their sarcophagus, but analyzed in their bodies. They were consumers of these things, and obviously cocaine is a drug. Have you found other evidence of other ancient cultures with products that would come from Central and South America like that? Because, I mean, I've read about that, but I find that fascinating.
I mean, most of this research was done in the 1990s by a lady called Svetlana Bababalona. I always get that name a bit confused as I talk about it. But, I mean, she was a toxicologist, I think still is, I think she's still alive, and did a lot of work on not just Egyptian mummies, but mummies from all over the world, and found, certainly in a great many of them, evidence of nicotine, which obviously comes from tobacco, but also in some of them she found cocaine. Others contained cannabis, although cannabis is clearly something that's known in the old world. And of course, the two contentious things here is tobacco and cannabis, and cannabis, cocaine, which comes from the coca leaf. Mm-hmm. Now, there is forms of tobacco, wild tobacco, growing in Africa. However, it's not the best variety. It can be used for smoking. And it, strangely enough, even before the time of Columbus, it was known as tobacco, or a word which sounds very much like tobacco. And of course, when Columbus reached the New World, he found the local people in the Caribbean and Bahamas smoking what they called tobacco as well, in these sort of like long pipes, which were like stuffed with the leaves of tobacco and smoked in this way, or they could use tobacco in poultices and things like that. And of course, it was adopted and brought back to the ancient world. And so basically to find it in, let's say, Egyptian mummies, it's something that is a mystery. But the skeptics will say that there was wild forms of tobacco, so it may just have come from somewhere in Africa.
Mm.
But the bigger mystery is why on both sides of the continent tobacco was called tobacco. Well, how comes it was called exactly the same thing? And that itself suggests previous contact between the African continent and the American continent in antiquity. So that's important. Mm-hmm. But then when we come to cocaine, which obviously derives from the coca leaf, that's a whole different ball game, because there is no evidence of coca leaf growing in the ancient world. I mean, I think that there was some slight slim evidence of a plant that was similar to it found in the Indian Ocean, but this really isn't on the map, and the island concerned was uninhabited in prehistoric times, so you know, it doesn't seem to have any basis in reality as far as how cocaine could get inside an Egyptian mummy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, skeptics dismissed this. They said there's no way that you know, a mummy dating to the first millennium BC could have had this in it. You know, quite clearly, some form of contamination has taken place. But the thing is that I do know that work has been done since then that I was privy to at the time of the writing of the book, which does confirm the earlier works of this toxicologist relating to cocaine. So it's not just an isolated thing. In other words, it's not some kind of anomaly that she got that was a one-off and can't be repeated. But then I started to look into, well, okay, could there have been some kind of trade that included the shipping of the coca plant from South America to Egypt? So I looked very, very long and hard into this, and I don't think it was direct. I don't think it was directly from South America. I think it was almost certainly via the Olmec culture of Central America. They were an incredibly cosmopolitan culture, and from the reliefs and the statues that we have of them, there were people there from, you know, the ancient world, the Middle East, from Africa, obviously from China, Southeast Asia, and obviously indigenous peoples as well, you know, indigenous to different parts of the Americas. And I'm certain that people were reaching, ancient traders, voyagers, mariners from the Mediterranean were reaching and trading with the Olmec at very early stage. And the only other alternative is that the coca leaf came across the Pacific and was traded probably via either China or one of the cultures of Southeast Asia,
mm-hmm.
And eventually was shipped along what's known as the Silk Road, all the way from China right the way through to the area of Turkey, and then obviously into the Middle East. That's mm-hmm. the other possibility. But I like the idea that it was done directly with the Olmec. And the Olmec, of course, you talked about the Maya. The Olmec were the spiritual ancestors of the Maya, mm-hmm. and almost certainly their knowledge of the construction of monumental architecture like pyramids, unquestionably, I would say, came from the Olmec.
Mm-hmm.
And the Olmec themselves, because they're a cosmopolitan culture, could have got these ideas easily from old world cultures.
Yeah. As a researcher, and in this new book, Atlantis and the Caribbean, you cover a lot of this this multicultural aspect of Central America. Why do you think that this is something that academics gloss over? When you look at the artistic ruins and artifacts of not only the Olmec but of the Maya, you clearly see Caucasian, Afrocentric, Asian people all over the place. It's like Absolutely. A melting pot for the world culture, and yet
Absolutely.
It's not yeah. discussed anywhere. And actually, in your book, you're very direct in showing these differences.
Absolutely.
Why isn't this not discussed? This is it's a big deal.
Well, obviously, there are certain researchers, academics, that are in this field. I mean, mostly, to be honest, they're in China because they haven't really got a problem with these ideas, believe it or not. It's us, you know, it's everybody else that's got a problem with them. And there is a great stigma here. And I think that it can be summed up in the whole Bay of Jars story here. Now, this is the fact that in Brazil, divers discovered these amphora jars, these huge, great jars in this bay that eventually became known as the Bay of Jars. And they were selling them, you know, to local antique dealers and whatever. And they got about, and eventually they got to a museum, and they recognized them as having come from the ancient world, probably from the area of Morocco. They were manufactured probably about 2,000 years ago. So about obviously at a time when the Romans would have been in control of North America, of North Africa. And so they called in this salver and underwater explorer, and he went to the area and they did a lot of radar surveys, and they actually found evidence of not one but two wrecks in that area. And unfortunately, as soon as this got out, everything stopped. And, you know, there was a huge controversy over this, and he was, you know, banned basically from ever going anywhere near it. Why? Because the discoverer of Brazil was a Portuguese navigator, and his statue is on every street corner. And no, they don't want anything changed. And it's as simple as that. And it was a similar story in one of the other Central American countries. I think, if I can remember, I think it was Nicaragua. A similar wreck was discovered. Again, disgorging jars. And exactly the same thing happened again. You know, as soon as it became known that there was a possible Roman wreck, and this was in a river that was in, you know, some distance in, then the whole thing, you know, was stopped, basically.
Yeah.
And why? It's because people don't want change. They don't want to have a history which is outside that taught in schools. And it was the same problem, of course, in North America with the whole Clovis First debate.
Yes.
That, you know, the Clovis people reached America via Alaska and Siberia, let's say around, you know, 11,000 BC, 12,000 BC, and that's it. Nobody else reached America before that time. And now that's beginning to crumble. Now we know that there were people in the Americas, probably from about 50,000, and arguably probably 100, possibly even 100, 150,000 years ago. Of course there were. I mean, people were not stupid in the past. You know, they knew how to build boats and to get around and to island hop or to coast hop. And they would have reached and they would have occupied the North American continent and the Southern American continent. In fact, more likely that they came up via Patagonia and that area, having entered the region probably via New Zealand and probably gone round the edge of Antarctica and reached the tip of South America and come up that way as early as 50,000 years ago, and as I said, probably much earlier still. But the thing is that academics don't want to know this because they have got their doctorates, their PhDs, their positions through the orthodox conventional view of history, and all of their papers, all of their books say this, and to accept these new ideas means that everything they've written is rot.
Yeah, rubbish.
So that's it. But quite clearly, the more evidence we have for things, the more our orthodox view of the past is overturned, and that happens very gradually. But people like myself, Graham Hancock, obviously other people in this field, you know, we're ignored for the most part by academics. And when the academics discover what we've discovered many years before were also ignored.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, the same theories will come out in academic papers and books, and we won't get a mention.
Well, you haven't developed a complex because of this, have you, Andrew?
I developed a complex. It pisses. Sorry.
I'd be pissed off too.
To be honest, it's expected, and to be honest, I don't care really. I write my books, and I believe that they've got brand new good research in them. And I believe that I'm on the right track. And if eventually the scholars, the academics find it and they put it in their own books, then people are only going to say, well, hold on, you know, we read this first in an Andrew Collins book or Graham Hancock. So nothing is lost ultimately.
Yeah, interesting. You talk about the great liberator, who I would say is post Younger Dryas devastation, and that's Quetzalcoatl, who is very well noted throughout Central America. And for the most part, he's considered a god. But you bring some interesting aspects of him that makes his presence a probable bit of information that he was actually a survivor of an advanced culture who did not only educate but also advise perhaps the rulers who were thousands of years before Montezuma and some of the other Mayan rulers. But can you tell us a little bit about what you discovered and what...
Well, I mean, Quetzalcoatl, or any other form of the feathered serpent, I mean, obviously the Maya referred to him as Kukulcan or as Itzamna, and there are other forms. Votan is another one. They all have very similar stories, and this is the fact that they turn up on a boat on the east coast of Central America, and they bring new knowledge and wisdom, which allows the establishment of high culture, whether it be, you know, the growing of maize and other forms of crop, or the building, how to extract metal from rocks, all these sort of things, which may well have been established in other parts of the world, but are obviously being brought into the Americas for the first time. And everything goes right, and then something goes wrong, and, you know, it all starts collapsing. I think with Quetzalcoatl, doesn't he get drunk and have sex with his sister or something like that? It's some weird story, which I'm sure Sigmund Freud would have a field day with. But anyway, and he wakes up and he realizes what he's done and realizes that he has to leave. And so he goes to the East Coast again, the same place that he came, and then sails off to this place, which I'm not going to try and pronounce the name Mexica, but it basically means something like the old red land, and it's an island somewhere that's, you know, beyond the horizon to the east. And he goes back there and disappears, you know, obviously saying I'll be back one day. And I go into great detail about this return of Quetzalcoatl. You know, and how obviously Montezuma was virtually expecting, Quetzalcoatl to return, and he's supposed to return every period. I think it's 52 years, I think, and you know, it can only happen on that day, and that's relating to conjunctions of the Pleiades and Venus and whatever.
Right.
And so Cortes. Hernandez Cortes turns up on that exact year. And obviously the description of Quetzalcoatl appears to have been that he was a fair god,
yes,
a fair skin. And everything about Cortes seemed to fit the bill. Now, whether this was pure coincidence or whether this was some strange quantum karmic destiny, who knows? But of course, this is one of the reasons why Montezuma allowed his country to be taken over by the Spanish conquistadors, and how the whole of the Aztec Empire came to an end in a very, very strange way. I mean, there was only a few hundred you know, conquistador warriors with horses and dogs and whatever. And they should have been beaten. They should have been killed at all sorts of points on their journey. And yet they didn't. They reached, you know, the former Mexico City, and they just waltzed in there, you know, shook hands basically with Montezuma. And he almost accepted that that was the end. It was almost like he'd resigned to the fact, oh, well, you know, Quetzalcoatl's turned up. It's all over now. I mean, yeah. It was just bizarre. It's an incredibly bizarre story. And the reason why I go into detail about it is because of the importance of Quetzalcoatl and the fact that he also arrived out of the east. And by strange coincidence, Cortes himself also left Cuba to reach, you know, the coast of Central America, mm-hmm. of Mexico, which, again, as I say, is where I think Quetzalcoatl had come from in the first place.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, we're not necessarily talking about a survivor of the cataclysm from, you know, 11,000 BC or whatever it is. I mean, quite clearly, this could have been a much later tradition. But it all gets mixed together. This is the problem with a lot of these myths and legends. They are regurgitated stories from much earlier period of time, which contain kernels of evidence of activity that goes back probably, you know, 10, 12,000 years. But the story itself might have related to the arrival of somebody in Mexico, maybe, I don't know, 2 or 3,000 BC. We don't know, you know?
Yeah.
So, but the whole thing's been blended together to give us a story that remains with us today. And you have to pick that apart, I think.
Yeah.
And that's where the speculation comes, because quite clearly, you know, I can interpret it one way and one of my colleagues can interpret it a different way. But that's just life.
Right. I want, if you could, give us a couple of good examples for why you think the Caribbean area, other than Cuba, is the heart of Atlantis. And this is why I want to ask you this, because Plato talks about these canals, these circular canals leading into Poseidon, the great city of Atlantis, and there's a lot of other descriptions that could be just his imagination. We don't really know, but what would you say are real solid evidence for, I mean, that you found that we don't really know about that you bring up in this new book?
Okay, right. Well, firstly, I think placing Atlantis in that region, I mean, there are some very vital clues here. I mean, the word Atlantis means daughter of Atlas. Atlas gives his name to the Atlantic because of a mountain called Mount Atlas, which is the last thing that a mariner will see if he leaves the African coast.
Mm-hmm.
And this huge mountain was considered to be, you know, the actual giant himself holding up the earth on his back. That's how that story came about. Although, you know, whether Atlas existed as a character beforehand or whatever, that's a matter of debate. So that's why the Atlantic was called the Atlantic. Well, initially the Atlantic Sea, and obviously today the Atlantic Ocean, is because it was the place of Atlas. And so to call somewhere Atlantis, the daughter of Atlas, and, you know, the reference to it to be in an island, it's quite clearly in the Atlantic. It's nowhere else. It's not in the Pacific. It's not in the Indian Ocean. It's not the North Pole or the South Pole. It's in the Atlantic Ocean, right? Then we come to the point of the islands that are linked to the opposite continent. The opposite continent is America. It's not Japan. It's not China. It's not, you know, it's not Antarctica.
Mm-hmm.
It is America. So we are definitely looking for somewhere in this area. Plato says that where the drowned regions of Atlantis were are now mud shoals. And although he says no more about that, other contemporary writers from that period talk about the same mud shoals that were encountered by the Carthaginian Phoenician mariners of the period. And they add one vital important point, that not only are there mud shawls, but also the area is covered in seaweed. Mm. And this means that they have to be talking about the Sargasso Sea. The Sargasso Sea is this massive area of seaweed, and almost like a dead area, really, a really quiet, still area that exists from the mid-Atlantic right the way across to the edges of the Bahamas. So we know he's talking about this general area. And the shallow waters, the mud shawls, almost certainly refer to the shallow waters of the Bahamas, which, as anybody that has been there will know, that almost universally everywhere around there, the waters are no deeper than, what, 10, 15, 20 feet, no more. Mm. And obviously they become very hazardous to ships and boats at certain places. And, you know, so in other words, Plato's got this garbled knowledge of the area around the Bahamas, the Sargasso Sea. And the other fact is that, again, a number of contemporary writers from the time of Plato talk about these massive islands that exist beyond the Atlantic. And they refer to them as the Hesperides. And the Hesperides, the size of them, the fact they've got navigable rivers, and they're supposed to be something like 40 days distance from the African coast, make them obviously in the area of the Caribbean. Mm. There is, again, no other alternatives here, as far as I'm concerned. So this is the general area that you should be looking for. And then you start focusing in on these particular large areas, the large islands that you've got, you know, Cuba, Hispaniola, Puerto Rico. And of all of those, it seems to be Cuba that seems to be referred to by Plato. It's the right shape. The mountains are in the right position. It's protected by the winds in the right location. Everything that he says. And as to the canals, precisely in the area that I indicate, and this isn't in the book because this all needs to be checked out. Mm-hmm. A colleague of mine, I won't give their name, has actually been looking at there, and they believe they have actually found those concentric canals in swampy region of southwest Cuba. But because they're American, they've not had a chance to mount an expedition because of the restrictions. Mm. On American citizens and whatever. But as I said earlier, now it's all opening up. You know, the American citizens can visit Cuba for the first time. And I believe that this is when Cuba will flower. No longer will it be seen as this grey, you know, country with a big red star over the top of it, which it has been, you know, since obviously the beginning of the 1960s. Now it's seen as almost the central hub of the Caribbean. And I think that only now will we begin to understand what its real place was in prehistory.
We don't really have, or I don't know of any writings by any archaeologists or researchers that live in Cuba that have documented any of their ruins. But that's probably going to be an eye-opener as more freedoms are allowed and people can get into that place. I bet you're looking forward to getting over there, aren't you?
Well, obviously I've been there.
Oh, have you?
It's an incredible country. I mean, it's remarkable. And it's actually a shame that it's going to change so much in the next, you know, few decades. And I think it will. You know, it makes me shudder to think that there's going to be McDonald's on every corner. You know what I mean? Because, I mean, I'm not literally mean that, but that whole change will change the whole vibe of the place. Mm. But at least it will bring money to the local people, and they desperately need it. Mm. But yeah, I mean, as far as archaeology is concerned, I think it's summed up by their books. I mean, you know, obviously they're in Spanish, but they're on really poor paper, and they're really, you know, some of them are really poorly produced. Mm-hmm. And that's clearly the best that they can do with the money that they've got in the archaeological institutes, things like that. Things need to change there massively. It's obvious that the archaeologists have not had the chance, really, to explore their own, you know, interior as in the way that they want, to do the right type of surveys, you know, ground penetration radar, you know, other aerial surveys, things like this, that would help us to perceive a much earlier presence of humanity on these islands. And I firmly believe that there's no way that somewhere like Cuba would have been avoided by humanity until around 6000 BC. I don't believe that at all. I think that there was high culture there, and that it was wiped out at the time of these cataclysms, which seem to have been absolutely devastating. And you know, the local legends say this. And I think that we will eventually find that, you know, that evidence. But I think that the best place to look at the moment is in the coastal waters.
Mm.
That's where you're going to find, you know, archaeological features, and they should be looked at first. I mean, obviously, the interior of Cuba is a whole different ball game. I mean, you know, you're talking about expeditions and things like this being mounted to try and find, you know, that these lost, quite literally, this lost civilization there, and I think it's there.
The last thing I want to mention to you and ask you is that Greg Little, working, and this is like, I want to say 20 years ago, used side sonars and scan Bimini area and some other underwater areas. And what appears in these scans are pyramids with the steps and anything. Have you seen any of those?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, look, I think that they've discovered an incredible series of structures, working obviously with the Edgar Cayce Foundation as well, who obviously have been looking at these areas for the last 50 years, as we know. But of all of the discoveries that they've made so far, I think the most important and impressive is what's known as Brown's Ruin. And this is an incredibly large strewn field of cut and dressed blocks to the south of Bimini, which is in a teardrop shape. And when you look at it, it's quite clear that something was there and it was hit by almost certainly something like a tsunami that has completely destroyed this structure. I mean, maybe it was a pyramid or building of some kind, and has laid all the rocks in a particular direction towards the south, as if something has approached it from the north. The positioning on the particular shoreline probably goes back to, well, it's at least been under the water since about 5000 BC. The rock is not indigenous to the region at all. It's what's known as blue schist. Which is, as I said, the closest sources of it are either Cuba, there's some in Jamaica, I think there possibly is some in Hispaniola, but there is none in the Bahamas at all. Mm-hmm. And yet there's thousands of tons of it there, and some of it is quite clearly cut and dressed. And in the northern part of it, it's laid out as what appears to be almost like a platform, as if like this was the central point of whatever the structure was. And this is something that Greg and Laura have investigated on several occasions. Laura gives lectures on this subject, and she's coming to our conference Origins 2016 in London with Greg at the beginning of November. Mm-hmm. To talk all about this, and obviously I look forward to that. But yeah, read about that. Brown's Ruins, very, very interesting. I mean, as I said, that's, to me, one of the most impressive sites that's been discovered. I mean, the others are important, and I think the other important thing is that the older they are, the deeper they're going to be. So you're talking about over 100 feet down, right, for those that would definitely have been on land 10,000, 11,000 years ago. And when you start getting to that type of depth, particularly in the Bahamas, diving becomes a lot more difficult. The currents are incredibly strong. it's a lot, the visibility is a lot more difficult. So it gets a lot more difficult to actually investigate them. Mm. You know, it's easy if it's only 10, 15 feet below the surface. Mm. So it's going to take some effort for us to really get to grips with what's down there. But it's there. The evidence is there. I mean, mm-hmm. you just got to look online, you know, look at the work that Greg and Laura Little have done. And obviously read my book. I mean, quite yes. clearly, all the evidence is there, all the photographs.
Yes.
Atlantis existed, and it was in the Bahamas and the Caribbean. And I think that Cuba was the flagship. I'm certain of that myself.
You have some really nice photographs in this book, and you actually show some evidence of these underwater features in Brown's ruins, which is fascinating. The book is Atlantis in the Caribbean and the Comet That Changed the World. My guest today has been Andrew Collins. Andrew, thank you for joining me. And if you want to, this book just came out, so you can get it on Amazon, of course. But I strongly urge our listeners to go to Andrew's website, which is andrewcollins.com. It's just packed full of information. And before we let you go, where are you going to be speaking? Tell us about your conferences that are coming up so people know where they can come and see you live.
Okay. We've got a big conference with a number of different authors, Robert Bouval, Graham Phillips, myself, Greg and Laura Little, and many more, Hugh Newman. That's in London on November the 12th and 13th. It's called Origins 2016, the Origins of Civilization Conference. So all the details of that is available on andrewcollins.com.
Okay.
We still have tickets available for that. And I'll be in America a few times next year. I'm going to Virginia Beach to the Ancient Mysteries Conference of the Casey Foundation in October 2017. So hopefully see a few of you there. And I'm almost certainly going to be at in California as well next year. But that's still to be arranged. So I won't go any further into that. So watch out there as well.
All right. Thanks very much. Again, you can get the book on Amazon.com, and it's a great reader. Very easy to read, great photographs and images and graphs, and it's a good book to have in your library, so make sure you can get it. All right. Thank you, Andrew. It was a pleasure having you on the program.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So that was Andrew. That book, I've had a chance to even look more in depth, and it's a really good book. He's done some good work. His books are always fun to read. And I don't think we mentioned that his website is andrewcollins.com, collins.com, andrewcollins.com. And I would sign up for his newsletter because, Graham Hancock's the golden child of ancient research because of his books and the popularity of his books. But Andrew is right up there. He does some tremendous research, and he travels everywhere. He's been all over the world, so I envy his travels. But you should definitely go to his website so that you get his newsletter. His monthly newsletter is outstanding. AndrewCollins.com. That was fun. Okay, as a reminder, next week we have Valerie Uvarov, and he is a Russian research scientist who has done quite a bit with pyramid energy, and he's going to be our guest next week. And what's fascinating about his work is he's building the only true pyramids now in Russia, and he's developed these pyramids and building them to show that when you live under them, not only do you extend your life, but you help your memory. And there's a lot of other amazing properties of living in a pyramid. So he's also going to be doing teaching and classes, and I think there's even a school. But we'll hear all about it next week on Earth Ancients. So don't forget to come back and hear that. As a reminder, Earth Ancients is sponsored by Gaia, and they're doing a new program with us. Go to gaia.com/Earth Ancients and check out this new offer for 99 cents. Starts the first month. And when you support Gaia, you support Earth Ancients. We really need you to be a supporter of our program so we continue to offer these great programs, and we just get better and better with support. So we'll have a ton of great programs that are coming up, and tools that you can learn and how to do different things. So support Gaia, support Earth Ancients, and when you do support Gaia, it helps us out. Gaia.com/Earth Ancients. All right. Hey, it's been fun, and we will see you next time.